Welcome to The Art of Construction, the podcast dedicated to helping you grow your business. Together, we'll explore the world of construction with some of the best minds of the industry. Your host, Evan Tilley, a micro-influencer and sometimes disruptor, will take you on a journey that will lead your business to the next level.
What's up, Art of Construction Tribe? Devin Tilley here, and we have a great one for you today. We have a platform that's coming to our platform. We're going to have a lot of great conversation about how we can build better buildings and as lifelong learners working together and actually doing it. Bryson Rayom, who we're going to talk with today, is he has done a lot of the life lessons that I've put into of EOS that I talk about and all these different things about construction is messy and you have to find a way to work it for you. But most importantly, that's where we have as much fun as possible to build a tribe. And so he has a platform. And the main message that I want to convey to you, tribe, is that to put the work required up front to ensure project success, it takes way more time and it costs more money. And most importantly, tribe, it requires trust. But I can tell you, the ROI will always be tenfold. And we always talk about begin with the end in mind. And that's what I found as I've researched Bryson's platform that we're going to talk about. But don't expect what you don't inspect. Let's go pull some other platforms and resources into what we're doing here with the Art of Construction. And how's that going to benefit you? On the project side, how do we dive deeper into setting up projects for success, right? We always talk about how we need to get a better cadence and do our projects and learn from the last project. But I raise my hand, tribe, and say, we all know we don't do that good enough because we're reacting too much in construction. And on the business side, some great business operating systems and softwares that will increase efficiency and provide a roadmap for growth. And so when it comes to Contech, we have to pay attention to that, but you got to find solutions that work for you. And so my perspective is that Bryson is a leader breaking down the AEC industry silos that we're always talking about by bringing together GCs and development experience to build better buildings. So let's take his lessons learned, that Bryson's impressive entrepreneurial journey in the AEC, and put that all together. But before we jump in and get to know Bryson in the speed round, every once in a while, we get the pleasure of having our executive director of the Art of Construction. We haven't had him in for a while because he has just been loaded up with so many great projects on our architectural side. But Matt is doing several developments and kind of coming in a lot of the similar veins, especially in doing projects in California where Bryson's at. Scotty and I said, Matt, got to come in, give us an hour. And Matt, what's your perspective? Welcome back to the podcast.
Hey, Devin, thanks for having me. Was wandering in the wilderness. And you brought me back into the fold. So thank you. Now, really looking forward to chatting with Bryson. I had a chance as well to look through some of the website links that he sent us. And his office is in Pasadena, home of the Rose Bowl. Been to two Rose Bowls, great facility. And two of my favorite places in California are in Pasadena, Descanso Gardens, which has a killer rose gardens, and a Japanese section with the pagoda. But then even more important is Pie and Burger, which is off of Lake Street. And Bryson, I'm sure, knows that. You go in there, you have a burger, but you want to save room for at least two pieces of pie because their pies are unbelievable. So really looking forward to the discussion here.
Awesome. And I have to tell one story as like, I don't know California really at all, except I had the pleasure of being on a TV show called Pros versus Joes, and it was in the old Orange Bowl stadium. And when I was on the TV show, behind the scenes, they were tearing down the Orange Bowl right after we filming all this TV show. And the power was like, they had like disconnected the power. So we were doing everything on generators. And I tell you this story, tribe, is because they were doing all these generators and it was like pouring rain. And I had to go do a 3-point competition against Dan Marley. And Dan Marley, like, they're like, the rain stopped, get out here. And we were supposed to be separated. But at this point, we were back in the old locker rooms that were just like a mess. And Dan Marley and I, he had Grey Goose vodka and we were back there just having all this fun. And they're like, all right, go time. And so we run out there. And I go to take the first shot and the generators quit. And then I just like paused. And like, that was the moment I was like, whoa, what did you get yourself into? Cause I looked out, I had to ask, there's 48 cameras And that was my, like, how hard it is to be in the spotlight, right? But how much fun it is when you do that, right? So anyway, that was just an off the wall story I had to say. But next, before we go in, I had a meeting yesterday, and I maybe a little have too much passion sometimes. And I was meeting with one of our master facilitators, Audrey Grubesic, and she's like, she gave me this whole like pitch about getting your mind right. And so she did this whole thing, and she's like, Devin, you got to start meditating and do all this stuff. So I went on, I usually ride the bike and just like go adventurous on the Peloton. But this morning I did meditation. And so we go in this, we're going to go into this conversation very calm. And thank you, Audrey, for pushing me to get into your lighter side. So we're going to meet with Bryson Rayom.
You know, here we go. Devin,
let's go have as much fun as possible, huh, Matt?
You know what they say, Devin? Meditation is better than mediation. That's just speaking as a developer.
All right, let's do this. Let's go have as much fun as possible with our man, Bryson Rayom. What's your favorite beverage?
Oh, favorite beverage. I mean, there's so many. It depends on the time of the day. I mean, most of the day I'm drinking sparkling water. I love that. Got to have my coffee in the morning. Talking about alcohol, ice cold lager of any type. I love that. And getting into cocktails, I'd say probably a Moscow Mule. So that's been my beverage of choice recently.
Well, we can definitely hang. That's from start to finish. I like all that. What's a favorite place you've traveled, Bryson?
I'll say probably Prague in the Czech Republic. It's actually where I met my wife 20 years ago. So it's a beautiful city. We've been back multiple times, and just unbelievable culture and absolutely gorgeous.
Awesome. Well, give us one story from being there.
Gosh, I would say, being from a construction and real estate background, we were there before the euro. And I remember my mother was a real estate agent back then. And I was only, I think, 19 at the time. And I remember, just because I grew up in a family of this, I looked up real estate prices while I'm in Prague, in downtown Prague. And I could have purchased a condo on the square back then. I think it was for 27,000 US. And I remember calling home to my mom and being like, it's a crazy idea, but I feel like this is a really good long-term investment. And she just laughed at me. It was like, go back to having fun. Like, you're a lunatic. And passed on it. And now those same places are probably $4 million, $5 million for one of those big places on the square. So yeah, that was kind of my funny story from being in Prague.
It's good though to have those lessons, right? Mm-hmm. Well, what is your favorite hobby or interest outside of the construction arena that we passionately call the art of construction?
It's hard, as you both know, being entrepreneurs, to find time for different hobbies and things like that. I was into Brazilian jiu-jitsu for a long time, had children and wasn't able to follow up on that as much. I think my recent hobby, getting a lot into the obstacle course races. So the Spartan races, the Tough Mudders, and something I did for a little bit of accountability on that was I published that to my entire firm, that I was going to complete a trifecta this year on the Spartan races. And I actually have one coming up in mid-October. So it was one of those funny things where, you know, I was really motivated when I published to the whole company. And then I was like, oh man, I actually have to do this. And so it's been a good kind of accountability thing for me. And this will be the last one of the year coming up in October.
Awesome. I did one Tough Mudder, and I like too many lagers myself. So I have a little bit of a belly, and at the end of the Tough Mudder, they had like this big like mud pit, and I couldn't help myself. And there's all these people, and I went and did this huge like belly flop into the mud pit, and I like sunk, and I was like, so, but then I got, and I had so much mud, and I ended up scratching my eye so bad I had to go to the emergency room, and I was hosting this big party after that. So I like go to the party and I come back with my eye patch, and is this like pick up where we left off. It was, I've never done that again. I've been more of a spectator on those events, but we commend you for doing that. So, yeah. Well, we're excited to have you here. What is your story that led you to being the founder and CEO of Rayom Richardson?
I grew up in construction. My father was a residential GC in the kind of Arcadia, Pasadena area. So it was kind of an old family business. I moved up north to San Luis Obispo in my high school years, and I started working for a construction company up there, Rouse Construction. So I worked in the trades for years doing concrete, a lot of framing work. So that kind of gave me a little bit of experience on the trade side. Joined the Army right out of high school. When I came back from the military, my father, who was retired at the time, one of his old clients had a project downtown LA, and it was a larger project. It was an adaptive reuse project. And he said, "Hey, you know, come down, work with me. We're going to do this one-off project. And then, you know, and then we'll finish it up. I just want to help this client out." So came to LA, and it was the Douglas Building Lofts in downtown LA. It was one of the first historic adaptive reuse projects in Los Angeles. And it was a complete disaster. My father came from a residential background, kitchens and bathrooms. I was coming from the trades. I had no business building. It was probably a $8 million project is what we went in at. I think we came out around $14 million. But the good thing was, it was a good group of people that came together to build this project. Everybody knew each other. So the developer, the architecture team. And so everybody kind of knew that we didn't know what we were getting into. Halfway through that, my father was like, "I'm out. I'm going back into retirement. You finish this up, have fun with it." And the good thing there was, I'd met a developer that was handling that development named Goodwin Gaw. And Goodwin had a ton of projects coming down the pipeline. So he said, "Hey, this was a tough experience for everybody, but why don't we set up a company? Why don't we start doing these other projects that I have lined up?" So I kind of jumped in feet first and said, "All right, you know, let's do this." And, you know, I look back on it, like, you know, it was kind of drinking from a fire hose mentality of, it was in the building that we were working on, myself with one to two other people, to going up to probably 60 people in a matter of 24 months, just handling as much work as we could. And that's kind of what kicked off Raome Richardson and let us grow over the years. Now, there's a huge arc there of leading up to 2008 and the crash and us scaling back, diversifying, bringing in a bigger client base. But that's kind of the history behind where we got started. And you know, I really credit Goodwin in terms of giving us our start in the early days and the opportunity. It was a really unique experience to have somebody like that kind of backing you and giving you those projects to grow.
You know, I was intrigued, Bryce, when I looked through your website and, you know, the project you just talked about, Douglas Lofts. I think I remember that. That was back in, late 80s, early 90s. And there was a lot of stuff happening in LA at that point. It was not, you know, sort of the 24-hour city that it was now. There wasn't a whole lot of folks living downtown. And they were really trying to encourage loft development and adaptive reuse. I know we, this must have been, I guess, a little bit later period, like in the early 2000s, late 90s, we had the Prince Hotel under contract by the Ambassador and came in and actually didn't redevelop it, but just flipped it to somebody who wanted to come in and do adaptive reuse to it. But one of the things that really caught my eye was Roosevelt Hotel, which is a great old facility. Can you talk a little bit about the adaptive reuse projects you've led, specifically Roosevelt Hotel and others?
Yeah, absolutely. And again, circling back to Goodwin Gaw, that was Goodwin's property. So Goodwin owned the Hollywood Roosevelt Hotel. And so we were lucky enough back then, I think that was, we probably started the Roosevelt renovations 2005, but then we didn't stop for 10 years because it was a hotel and there's a lot of different facilities within the hotel. So when we went into that hotel, I think our first project was the pool rooms and the cabanas and Teddy's over there. And so that's the area where we had shut down that portion of the hotel, kept the tower open, gutted all the pool rooms, completely gutted the pool area, the bars, everything. And again, lucky enough to be working with Goodwin in kind of a partnership scenario. So we had the ability to get in there, make mistakes and kind of learn along the way. But that was a great experience overall in terms of, you know, what does it take to renovate these old historic buildings? You know, working with the historical commission, what you can and can't do. And we went from that portion of the hotel to doing the tower rooms, to doing Teddy's bar, the library bar, the Blossom room, circling back 5 years later to redoing the pool rooms again with another group. So we stayed on that hotel for almost 10 years. And that's kind of how hotels work. Projects kind of come and go in terms of, I'd say every 5 years, they're rebranding, redoing the hotels and things like that. But in terms of adaptive reuse, the difference is, you know, the historic adaptive reuse boutique hotel market, I would say that is probably one of the most difficult adaptive reuse you can do. And that's something that we learned early on. We did multiple hospitality projects in that sector. And, you know, it became a niche product for us. We became known for it. And we started doing a lot of it. And it was one of those things where, as we started diversifying, getting into other project types, we realized just how difficult those projects were. Because when we had the opportunities to do, say, larger tenant improvement projects or, you know, studio projects or something like that, we said, wow, these projects are very, very simplistic and less complex than what we've been working on. And so we learned a lot through those in terms of what types of project we were working on in the future there.
You know, to continue on that vein, you know, with the Hollywood specific plan and things like that, can you talk about how important it is to have the municipality on board? I know Hollywood and City of Los Angeles has really encouraged because of industry and actors and the history, Frank and Musso, you know, all that kind of stuff, how important it is to have the municipality and city council and things like that in favor of restoring properties.
Yeah, it's hugely important. I mean, that's one of those things where sometimes it's beneficial. It depends on the developer you're working with and what they want to do with the actual building. So we've been lucky enough to work with developers that are very passionate about historic adaptive reuse. So they take it seriously. They really want to bring back the beauty of the old historical building. Where we've also worked with developers that hate that. Really, they want to tear out all the windows. They want to redo the facade, but they run into that historical fabric, and then they're fighting with the city all the way through. So having the the city municipalities on board and having those agencies behind you is hugely beneficial, because what it ends up becoming is you're almost negotiating with them on what you can and can't do. So we've done a ton of work, and we've done a lot of quality work. So we actually became kind of known for that type of work, and we came first name basis with a lot of these key players in the city of LA. So when they were working with us and we were working on specific projects, they knew that we were always going to be trying to do what was right for the project from a historical standpoint. So that gave us a little bit more leeway when we were working with our clients and things like that. We were able to really help our clients get the projects developed a little bit more efficiently. Where if you go out and you're fighting against them from day one, and you're trying not to budge on, hey, we need to redo all of these historical windows, or we need to keep these historical lobbies intact, it's kind of a losing battle, and you're going to lose, months and years on it.
One of my favorite things going into when building and safety used to be in the old LA City Hall building was they used to have a sign up above the main help desk. And it said, an emergency on your part does not necessarily constitute one on ours.
Yeah.
And I used to stand there as a young guy listening to developers talking exactly about what you were talking about, of wanting to fight or argue.
Yeah.
And the person would just point to the sign up above them. And I thought that was hilarious, you know?
Yeah. And that's probably, that's probably the majority of the conversations that everyone's coming in. It's the most important thing in the world. And, I know the mayor, I'm going to call the mayor. You see those conversations happening every day.
Well, I love that tee up, right? And I want to recap a few things that you said. Is that you said we're $8 million in and it was $14 million out on one of your first projects. And there's a lot of stuff that has to be learned there. And when you start that false summit of getting the job to then figure out, we're just getting started. But what I kept hearing is passion got you through. And that's why we have these conversations, because a lot of times it's quote unquote easier just to tear down the whole thing and then just come back with all new. It may be easier, but then you got to niche in and say, a bulldozer can come in. Anybody can hire someone to take a bulldozer to it, right? Mm-hmm. But adaptive boutique character structures is really, and that really hits home to me, because I'm at, our retreat center that I've taken over and it's appreciating the old West that we called Turkey Toe. And we take clients down there, and it's an old, old log cabin that is a lot of work to keep that character and charm, but you can't replace character and charm. If you really want to say this building was built in the 30s and it's still here and we still work on it. And that backdrop is different than just tearing it down. And so the thing that I want to really niche in is that what I heard from you is piss poor planning is piss poor execution, which is really hard to do if you're doing boutique structures. Mm-hmm. So can you talk, the adaptive reuse when it comes to the boutique, but what all does Rayom Richardson do?
Yeah. So, I mean, specifically for adaptive reuse in terms of, how are you setting those projects up for success? You can't look at those projects like your standard ground up multifamily projects. You can't look at those projects like your large 50,000 square foot interior tenant improvement projects. And we've spent a lot of time educating our clients over the past 5 years. We've been fortunate enough to get to a point where if a client or developer doesn't share our mentality, we'll always be a hard pass on not approaching those projects with the right mentality, because they are very difficult projects. And if you don't approach them from the right standpoint, you're going to have a very difficult time. And it's going to be painful for everybody involved, all the way down from the developer, all the way down to the, you know, the last person on that project. So we spend a lot of time early on saying, look, it's about the pre-planning. You know, it's about the teams that you're putting in place. It's about the pre-construction that you're doing on these jobs. The amount of times that we've had developers come to us on large $30 to $50 million adaptive reuse in downtown LA, and they've worked on these projects for 24 months, great design teams, great designs, full spec books. And they come in and they say, here's a set of plans. We've put it out to 5 GCs. We have 3 weeks. Can you give us our numbers back? And that to me, and that's an old style of doing construction. And it's still to this day, shocking to me that savvy developers will continue doing this. And I'll look at them and I'll be like, you can't do this, number one, and I'll spend time, I'll pass immediately, but I'll say, I'd love to grab coffee with you just to tell you why we're passing on it and the reasons behind it, because this project is going to be difficult for you from start to finish. So we just kind of go through the process of educating them of, we'll routinely spend 6 to 9 months in pre-construction on those style of projects, working with the architecture team, working with MEP engineers, working with structural, bringing in our sub base, getting quality subcontractor input on the projects. Because if you don't, you're going to find out all those issues a quarter of the way through the project. And on those style of projects, it can absolutely kill a project. It can delay it for months and months. Your costs are going to go through the roof. And what's funny about it from a GC standpoint is, again, depending on what type of GC you are, if you low bid one of those jobs, knowing what an adaptive reuse historical project is, you're in the best place you could be from a GC standpoint, because you have a set of plans that most likely doesn't sync up with the building. Nothing's going to work out. So you're in this position where, well, it's going to be change orders and delays and change orders and delays. So if you have that mentality as a GC, great, that's going to work well for you. You probably make a lot of money on that style of project. But for us, it's a quality of life thing. It's about doing good business with good people. So we always say, look, this is not going to work out well for you. It could potentially work out well for me, because we know how these projects work and where it will go. But you need to stop and you need to rewind and you need to get the teams involved from day one to do the proper pre-planning and pre-construction to make sure this job is a success overall. And that goes back to the architect that you select. You know, the amount of architects that we see selected for historical adaptive reuse that have never done them before is very common. The MEP engineers being selected have never done them. The structural teams doing them have never done them. And you don't want to be that firm's learning curve at the end of the day. So that's something that we focus on is on the cooperative side, on our owner's rep management side, of really making sure that whatever project we're working on, the teams are well-versed in that project type so they can be successful at the end of the day.
You bring an important point up, you know, and it really is sort of old school. You know, we kind of call it design bid, fingers crossed, can we build, you know, as in, can we afford it?
Yeah.
And so when I did look, you know, through your stuff, it seems like you guys are kind of a renaissance firm, you know, in a sense. And I think a lot of our audience really understands that, is it requires a lot of different skill sets. You know, like me personally, licensed architect, went back and got a master's in real estate and construction management so that I could do feasibility analysis, and then got a brokerage license so I could participate in my own development projects. But when I look through your firm, it seems like you have a lot of different services, offerings, and platforms that include feasibility analysis, construction management. Can you talk about Raylan Richardson and how you've expanded beyond just being a GC in order to fully serve your clients?
Yeah, absolutely. And again, the core business, Raylan Richardson as the general contractor. And what we found is, and you know this very well, Matt, from a real estate standpoint, when you're a GC and you're building and you have the the ability to work with great developers, great architecture teams, real estate development just becomes a natural evolution if you're a general contractor. So early on, we got into real estate development with some good friends that really pushed us in that direction. And we realized early on that because what we'd experienced with developers and architecture teams, we very quickly excelled in that space because we took all the things that we learned from the GC side, seeing all the struggles that our clients had gone through, and were able to easily circumvent that from the real estate standpoint. So when we started doing our own projects, our projects were very clean, very streamlined. We got them renovated. We got them stabilized very quickly. So we kept on that route, and that's where our kind of real estate development side kind of came from. And now we're building that up into a much bigger platform. On the owner's representation construction management side, again, a natural evolution. What happened there was our clients really liked working with us on the construction side, to the point where when they started doing new projects, they would actually come to us first. And they'd say, hey, we're going to do a new project. Can you help me put the team together? Who would you like to work with on this project? And so we naturally got into the construction management side under the GC brand. And again, with core clients that were requesting it. So we just started doing that naturally, to the point where the requests became so frequent that we said, all right, let's start another firm here because we need a clean separation between the management side and the GC side. And on the management side, again, we loved jumping into that space because being on the build side and seeing all those problems and going through them on a project by project basis and seeing very clearly how you could have avoided those early on, but not having the ability to, you know, give the owners that feedback, give the architect that feedback, it kills you after a while. You're like, we could have solved all this very early on, but you didn't want to spend the time. You didn't want to spend the small amount of money that it would have taken to do it. So now that we're on the owner's representation construction management side, we have that ability. And it's a game changer for our clients and a game changer for doing quality, you know, efficient projects at the end of the day.
I want to ask a follow-up on that. Do you see you guys yourselves going into property management as well too? Do you guys do develop and hold? The reason I ask that is one of the developers we work with here in Denver, they do multifamily in the affordable space, and they end up, you know, obviously because of LIHTC and other things like that, had 221D4s, they end up doing property management and hold. Is that someplace that you guys are looking to move into in the future as well?
Yeah, we're kind of, again, a natural evolution. We're doing it internally on our own right now. And that conversation did come up just last week, actually. So we're getting into some of our larger projects and looking at, you know, a 100 unit or 200 unit complex. That was one of the key discussions of how are we going to handle our property management on this? And one of our partners said, well, why don't we do this ourselves? Why are we going to be outsourcing this to a third party? So definitely on the boards. And as everyone on this call knows, you know, being very entrepreneurial, it's one of those things where you got to, you know, we always want to jump into new things. Like, yeah, we're going to do that, right? Because we love starting businesses and we love doing new things. But as I get older, I'm a little bit more thoughtful about, you know, time management, who's going to do it, how are we going to do it? So we love the idea and we're definitely looking into that.
Yeah, I have to tell, I was in a business dinner the other night and we're in the final stages of launching the AOC IT house through our Envision software and all these things I've been working on for the past 10 years with the master facilitators. And we were getting down this vein, just like you're talking about with the entrepreneurs and all working together about how and where we're going to do this. But first it starts with who, right? And so we're there and we're figuring out who is going to be the how this is going to come together. And we're like, well, let's just stop here and look around here. We're at this beautiful setting and we're like, look at that ceiling and look at those railings and look at this, like everything just feels and works right. Well, that's getting so hard in construction, right? Mm-hmm. Because when you put that final piece of trim in this setting, that's a piece of art. It's not just a commodity. And that's what you talked about, to say you better understand if you're going to make this setting come together, because that beauty cap is the tie-in to where everything has to begin with the end in mind and be put together. And that's why these computational tools are so important, and understanding to be able to scan what's there and create this virtual experience, but that has to go somewhere of how you're going to adaptive reuse, because it's messy, right? And it's hard. And you talked about how you just say no right up front. And that is so meaningful when you say that, Bryce, and it's like, you know who you are. And if someone comes in and just said, can you be the lowest bidder right off the bat? You say no, but. And I love that, to say the no, but, so you don't get bullied, right? And we follow the no asshole rule. And that's really, I think, what you're talking about. Because there's plenty of assholes out there that will just bulldoze you, right? Mm-hmm. And take that change order mentality. And that doesn't fit what we're doing with the AOC master facilitator mindset. And so when Matt talks about design bid and fingers crossed, it's going to get built. I'm so jazzed for you to tell us about what you're doing of your legacy as a lifelong learner. Tell us about what you're doing with the cooperative and what your mission is all about there.
Yeah, absolutely. So, you know, kind of our published mission there is, and you can see it on our website, you know, it's to provide absolute predictability of outcome through process and procedure. And again, that goes back to all of the things that we learned on the GC side, all of the things that we've learned on the real estate development side. So taking all of that knowledge and really trying to package it up and bring that back to our clients and say, look, we've been building for 20 years. We've been developing for 10 years. So we see a path forward that can provide you with a more efficient, sustainable way to build at the end of the day. And so we're kind of packaging all that up now and bringing that out to our clients. And we're having a lot of success with it. And really, it really comes back to this idea of collaboration and working with the teams early and getting everyone's input and everyone's feedback early on. And again, it's one of those areas where you're going to spend a little bit more time up front. You're going to spend a little bit more money up front. But the ROI, as you mentioned early on, Devin, is tenfold. There's no scenario where you are not going to see your return on investment from spending that time up front. So that's kind of our mission moving forward, is to be able to take this. And it's a very simplistic mentality at the end of the day. There's no rocket science behind it. And that's always what's fascinating about construction, is it is a simple science at the end of the day, but a lot of people avoid or don't want to spend the time on these very easy fixes up front. And we're trying to work with clients that share that mentality. And again, we've put ourselves in a really good position, and we've surrounded ourselves with clients that share that mentality. So I naturally see or feel like I'm seeing an industry shift. And I don't know if that's truly happening or it's just us surrounding ourselves with the right clients and the teams that share that mentality. But we want to push that forward. And we also want to take that mentality of saying no and then educating the people that don't share that mentality. So that's one of those things where if you're in a position, we're constantly telling people. I work with another really big cost management firm in LA. Great firm, known the players for years. They do big projects, but they came to us the other day on the GC side and say, hey, we're doing this big members club. You know, it's a $20 million project. Same thing. They worked on it for a year and a half, 2-week bid process. So I know this guy closely and I said, we're not bidding it, but I called him and I said, what are you doing? This is your job. You are the owner's rep. You are the cost manager. Why in the world would you go through this process? Because you know the outcome and I know the outcome. And he laughed and said, I know, Bryson, I know it's going to be a mess. So he knows going into it. But what he told me was, this is what the client demanded. And I don't want to lose this client because it's a huge client for us. So that's one of those tough conversations where it's like, do they step up and say no? This is incorrect. This is not how you do construction. This is why you hired me, to tell you what you don't know. But a lot of times, and again, it's easy to say this, but when you're looking at revenue and you need to pay bills, a lot of times you got to do what you have to do. But we're just trying to say, hey, if you have the opportunity to say no and to educate clients, usually what you'll see is they'll come back to you after a project or two that doesn't work out well.
You bring up two great points. You know, one is, I guess I'll call it, your own firm's cash flow projections, right? I mean, that is a huge risk and consideration that you got to take in. The other thing is, when you were talking, I was thinking about, I don't think people fully appreciate development and developers and the risks that they take on, really. I mean, the thing that you're dealing with is you're dealing with the real estate cycle, which is totally outside your control. There are so many things going on, you know, that people know about right now, inflation, consumer price index, all that stuff that's happening. And then you have the uncertainty of the AHJs, right? The authorities have a jurisdiction, and how are they going to come down on this? And so communication, I think, is the key. And it sounds to me like the cooperative is really pushing that, is that you're getting all the players at the table and you're bringing that communication to the table so that people are looking for surety, right? They're looking for surety and stability. So can you give us a little bit of a test case or a model beta case that you use where you brought some folks together in order to minimize that risk?
Yeah, absolutely. And again, I think it's just the idea of how do we see it? What's our mentality of setting these projects up for success, whatever project it is? So, you know, where we start and what we've seen is the classic way of doing a development, depending on who it is we see a lot of teams that are just cherry picked, thrown into a pot, put on the path and say, hey, we hope this works out. We all know the general terms of how development works, but there's no forethought in terms of, you know, have these teams work together? Are they specialists in these spaces? So where we found success is it's kind of, and you mentioned EOS early on, Devin, of the right people, right seats. So we take that to the project level of right firms, right seats. But we take that even deeper. So it's this idea of when you're selecting the teams for a project. So let's start with architecture. You're going to Gensler or you're going to HOK or one of these great firms, great brands. You know they do good work. But we don't stop there and say we're going to go work with one of these great brands or one of these great firms. What we say is, number one, what's our project type? So let's say we're working on a historic adaptive reuse project, since we're talking about that. Well, if we're going to go talk to a Gensler or a HOK or somebody like that, that's great that it's Gensler, but that doesn't mean anything to us. What I want to know is who's the architect within Gensler that I'm working with? And I want to go deep and I want to interview that architect. I want to know the adaptive reuse projects that they've worked on. And I want to know the success that they've had on those projects. Now I'm okay with that team member. Great. That doesn't matter that it's Gensler, but I know that architect has that experience. We'll go deeper than that. So now that we've found the right architect and we know that they have the experience, now we need to look to find our structural teams, our civil teams, our MEP engineering teams. I'm not just going to go to teams that I know and I like. My first question is going to be to that architect. Hey, who have you worked with in the last 6 months to a year that you really like, that you know excels in this space? Well, we really love GLUMAC, or we love this engineering term. Fantastic. Is there a specific engineer at GLUMAC that you know that you love? Yeah, I really love Eric over there. Eric's amazing. I've done a project with him. Fantastic. So now we've got somebody that we know on a personal level, we know is experienced on the architecture side, bringing us to an engineer that they've worked with in the past, that they know our experience in those spaces as well, down to the civil line, down to the structural line. So you can immediately see the value there of putting a true team together. Not Gensler's worked with GLUMAC, has worked with this firm before, but the people within those firms. And if you can do that and you can spend that time up front, the impact is unbelievable, you know, because now you're working with a true team of people that all respect each other, value each other. The finger pointing goes away. It's a collaborative effort out of the gate because those relationships already exist. So if you can start there, you're going to have a much more successful project overall.
That's a great point. It's really like the NBA All-Star game, man. It's like the AEC All-Star team.
Yeah.
And because it is important. People like working with people they like. Mm-hmm. But you also like people, you also like working with people who know what the hell they're doing, right? So you got to have both of those pieces. That everybody has to play well together, but everybody also has to know what they're doing.
Yep.
While we're in this deep dive segment, Scotty mentioned to me, like in the pre-interview when he was talking with you, that you guys have a strategy where you're partnering with local churches. And that really interested me because we have a project going on right now with a developer. We're doing a 90 unit independent senior living project with the Archdiocese of Denver.
Oh, nice.
On some excess land that they had. Can you talk a little bit about that? Because I know some churches are flush with cash. Other churches have de-gentrified, where neighborhoods have changed and they've gone from maybe an affluent community to a lesser affluent community. That's our particular test case situation. And by doing a long-term land lease, it was able to provide a cash infusion into the parish for some much needed improvements. Can you talk a little bit about what you're doing in Southern California?
Yeah, I mean, you essentially touched on the core of it with what you mentioned in Denver. And where it really came from was, again, we're in real estate, so we're looking at deals and things like that. So a church close by, a full church property just came up for sale, seemed like a great deal. So I remember going to tour that property with the brokers and the owners. And the thing that came right away walking is I could tell immediately that the church didn't want to sell, that they were in this position where they were being forced to sell. And it was just a sad scenario overall because, you know, the congregation had dwindled, they didn't have the money, and they just ended up in this position where they could no longer operate. So, you know, what we realized was a lot of these churches aren't just sitting on the land that their core church sits on. A lot of them own a lot of land around them, whether it's been donated to the church over the years. So we kind of realized that we could go in early and exactly what you said, create a JV, find a way to monetize their existing land that they have while allowing them to still keep the church in operations. And again, it's a very straightforward, very simplistic program. And we've been lucky enough locally to begin working and partnering with some key groups that have been doing it for a while now. But it's just the program of finding the right churches that need this help and providing a very straightforward JV scenario and land lease situation where it's like, you have valuable land. So we can come in and essentially help you develop that, create a new revenue stream for you. And usually it's a very good revenue stream because most of this land is usually fully paid for. There's no debt on it. And allow them to kind of continue their mission with the church. And the feedback has been unbelievable because churches were dying before the pandemic, and the pandemic put them down even farther. So churches all over the nation have been struggling.
Well, I think it's a great service that you're providing to faith communities because, you know, as you know, and even more so in LA, they're really weavers of the social fabric in the LA area because, you know, LA is so sprawling, it's kind of hard to get your hands around community. And so that's what these churches do in those particular communities is provide a third place for people to congregate around. So good on you for doing that.
Absolutely. And yeah, you said to your point, LA, it's very key for communities. And it's amazing how many churches there are and the little micro communities that are built around them. So I think there's a lot of opportunities for the churches to take this opportunity, revamp, and again, continue their mission on, keep serving the community while creating more revenue for them.
Right firm, right seats. That totally resonates, right? And that's what we have to take talking tracks and put them into our platforms to where what I heard from you is you first have, you have to have these great brands, but you have to have that team of great people within those brands. And that's what we're building with the AOC Master Facilitators. It's first, it's who, and then what are we putting together? Because that's when I set out to start this thing. One of the things I thought one of the greatest challenges in the art of construction was it would be the what leads the who. And that's a real challenge when here is what we have to offer and then who has to follow that. And that gets really tricky in the reference of churches because churches need a lot of maintenance back to the adaptive reuse. And we want to be here to help keep these going. We don't want to be forced out and have these communities to have to change what they want to do because churches aren't just a digital stream that had to be with COVID. So I think, you know, I look at my church and it was a, you know, major challenge to the community because they had revamped the whole church and then COVID hit and they, you know, they, it's hard to ask for a lot of money when no one's there. Right. So you have to figure out how to adapt. So when we talk about adapting, what philosophies and strategies have guided the way you've built up all of your different companies?
Yeah. I mean, we've been doing this for, you know, over 20 years now. And we've all heard this before, but it's one of those things that I think is worth reiterating. For us, it's always been kind of people first. And it took years of running a business to really let that sink in. You know, you hear it and you're like, yeah, people first. I get it. You know, people are important. But until you run a business for years and had some attrition and had some setbacks and built back up, it doesn't really sink in just how true it is that to be a successful business, to grow, to scale, you have to be people first. You know, it has to be about finding the right people, grooming the right people, you know, and treating them right, and creating a great culture within your business. So in terms of strategies of building any company, we've always had that mentality of let's start with the people. Who are the right people, the right seats? And it's not easy. You know, it's very difficult to find the right people that share that culture, have that drive, and want to come in and do something special. So if you find them, we do everything we can to hold on to those people, because that's the magic that helps you grow. And then past that, finding the right operating systems and things like that. So you mentioned EOS and Traction. So we've been operating under EOS and Traction for, you know, I think about 7 years now. We've been in business for over 20. And I'll tell you what, it's one of those things where, God, I wish somebody would have given that to me 15 years ago. The amount of setbacks that it would have solved for me.
Ain't that the truth?
Yeah. So we've had a ton of success with that in terms of creating a structure and a framework and an operating system for us to operate under. We use 90.io, which is one of the softwares related to EOS, which has been fantastic. Procore is what we use internally to help us manage and grow. Sage from an accounting standpoint. So we really lean into the proper softwares and things like that to make us more efficient overall. But I will say we don't get too tied down to, hey, we have to follow EOS exactly to the letter, because we did that for a while and realized we had to step back and take what worked for us and kind of pivot. And we took the things that worked really well, left the things that didn't, and that works well as well. So being flexible with your operating systems and things that you're setting up, and not going too far down the line. If you're realizing that something's not working, not just dying on the sword saying, well, it's going to work eventually because everyone else says it works. You got to be able to step back, reset, reevaluate, say, okay, let's try this now and see if this works. So being flexible as you're growing, I think, is really key as well.
100%. And it all boils down to being adaptive, but you have to have systems to be able to adapt to, right? Exactly. And so in my window and door company, we went all in and had a coach for 2 years, and we paid to have two different locations going, and it was a fascinating, challenging, expensive, all those types of things at the same time. Because a lot of my other coaches or my CFOs are looking at this stuff saying, Devin, you're not making any money today. I'm like, well, yeah, I got to learn how to be a better leader and lead better teams to then eventually. And it's back to at the beginning of this, you have to put all that work on the front end and have these systems to be able to do that and mm-hmm. be able to adapt. And now we're doing the exact same thing and blending all that, just meeting structures and how you facilitate these different projects, because it boils down to communication, and construction is about setting those boundaries for communications at the right time, at the right place, to be able to have the right people and who's accountable for what. I totally love all that. And it makes me think about the different moments in time when I have these podcasts. I had Richard Palmer Smith on the podcast, who was my coach for EOS. And then Jason Blanker, who I met him through, you know, finding we were both trained in EOS. So you find these people like I've found with you today, Bryce, and we've both mm-hmm. been trained in common things that we can adapt to be AOC master facilitators. And that's where Jason is bringing his software of Envision into the platform. And it all started by building that trust. For hundreds and hundreds of podcasts, I've asked that. And I've told so many people, I asked Jason his favorite beverage, and he's a founder in a brewery. And I was like, man, that beer sounds amazing. And I've told this story so many times. And I'm telling you this again today, Tribes, you have to stop and think about this stuff. When I in the mail, I got a 6-pack on dry ice to say, enjoy my favorite beverage. And I was like, wow, this guy gets it. And now we've become master facilitators together. And it's not Devin or Jason or Bryson. It's a cooperative, right? Mm-hmm. So that's where I was really passionate about bringing you into the conversation. Any other tips or resources for aspiring entrepreneurs like us that you would put out on the table?
I think one of the big things is just jumping in. You know, I see a lot of people with great ideas that kind of go unanswered because they're really just, you know, a little hesitant to take that leap, to try something new. And, you know, I understand not everyone has the luxury to take the risks that others have. Some people don't have the backstops they need. But if you have the idea and you think it's a good idea and you can find that backstop, number one is taking that leap, because I've seen so many brilliant, intelligent people not move forward with things just because they were a little bit too worried, a little bit too scared, and they kind of stayed in the lane they were in. When I'm like, if you would just take that leap, it would probably be something really amazing. And then I think another thing is, from an entrepreneurial standpoint, it's difficult being an entrepreneur. There's a ton of weight on your shoulders all the time. You're usually employing a significant amount of people, and their livelihood kind of depends on the decisions that you make in your executive team and things like that. So I've always said, you know, you got to stay positive, and sounds simple, but you know, when we're dealing with very heavy things and payrolls and things like that, it's difficult, but staying positive, having that kind of attitude of gratitude overall, things like working out, meditation, staying healthy and fit. I think those are things that people don't take as seriously as they should when they're entrepreneurs. Because if you don't have that healthy mindset, healthy body, it's difficult to do what we do on a day-to-day basis. So it's having that courage. It's staying in the right mindset. You mentioned meditation early on. That's key. You know, it's one of those things where there's enough science and background behind it now to show the benefits. So get into that if you haven't tried it. It's a stressful business that we all work in. And if you can find anything to relieve that stress to help you be more efficient and positive overall, I think that's a win.
One thing I just send it over to Matt is that we just hosted our warrior retreat last weekend. And it's fascinating. The first year is kind of that, just get it there and who's who, right? And it's a marathon and sprint at the same time. But after 2-3 years, I've been doing it with my dad's Dave thing for 42 years. And after you do this longer and you get a cadence, it's amazing how you let the guard down, right? And that's how you can cooperate together, right? Mm-hmm. Matt?
Yeah, I just want to jump back a second and and say, when you told the story about Jason Blinker sending you beer on ice, dry ice, is that a solicitation for the tribe to send you from their favorite beverages?
Don't steal my thunder, just let it play.
All right, just an observation. Bryson, I just wanted to ask you this question. You know, it seems like you've created a pretty collaborative project team model with cooperative. What do you think it's going to take, other than like pain and suffering and recessions and things like that, for the rest of the AEC industry to come to that realization about collaboration?
Yeah, it's a great question, and one of those things that we struggle with internally. But you know, I think it's the kind of the constant reminder and education of our clients that we're all working with on a day-to-day basis, whether it's developers or the brokerage teams, that there is a better way to do things, that we have to be more collaborative as an industry. We have to get the GCs involved earlier on. We have to bring teams together, get the sub base involved early on. So, and again, it's difficult. Again, there's always the revenue question. There's always the paying bills question. But if you can say no to projects that don't share this spirit and do it in a positive way, and follow it up with education on why you're saying no to that project, because you're trying to change the industry, you're trying to make things more positive, and you're trying truly to provide that client with a better experience. And if I keep saying yes to this model where you keep having a negative experience and not knowing why, or blaming the architect or blaming the GC, when there is a clear way to kind of solve those problems, it's not helping anybody. So again, you got to have the luxury to be able to say no. But if you do have that luxury, my kind of comment to the general industry is to take that luxury, say no. It's going to be a little bit of pain, but I think what will happen is we'll see clients start to come back, because once you educate them, and the key point is education. Don't just say no. Hey, this person doesn't agree with what I'm saying, I'm out. Say no, be thoughtful, try and get them out to lunch, try and take them to coffee, really tell them why. They're probably still going to say no. That's what we found. People will say, no, I get it, but I don't want to spend that money. But let them go out and have that difficult experience again. Put a calendar reminder a year from now to follow up with that client and say, hey, how'd that project go? Remember our conversation? And remind them that, oh God, you know, I did experience all those things they told me I was going to experience. And maybe 1 to 2 projects later, they're going to come back to you and they're going to agree. And boom, you've just helped shift the industry towards that model a little bit more.
That's really well said, man. there's no teacher-like experience, you know, and eventually, you know, you keep rubbing things the wrong way and you get the rash, you get tired of it. So
yeah, absolutely.
I think that's really well said. Well, hey, we ask this of all of our guests, and Devin's thrown it my way to ask this time. If you look in your crystal ball, what do you think the future holds for technology and construction, and specifically in your niche in the industry?
Yeah, the technology question is coming up more and more. And it's interesting because we're seeing a lot of amazing stuff come to the forefront. And I think some of the key things that I've seen that I'm tracking and I really like is the low hanging fruit is obviously software, right? There's better software coming out on a day-to-day basis. And I love the idea of somebody coming out with a key software more related to like integrated project delivery, kind of this collaborative method. We have the Procores and we have things like that, but it leaves a little bit of the client out. It leaves a little bit of the developer out. So I would love to see the software push more in that direction to really creating something amazing, user-friendly that drives this collaborative process. Robotics, I think, is a big movement right now. And we're seeing the robotic layouts and things like that. So I think that is going to become the norm in the next 10 years, especially on the larger ground up projects. You're going to see a lot more of that. A little bit more difficult in the adaptive reuse space, but in the core ground up world, I think we're going to see more of that at the end of the day. And then virtual reality, I think, is going to be something that is used more and more. I've gone to a couple events where they've had, events in empty core and shell spaces. And, you know, you put on the headsets and you can completely see the floor built out in front of you. You can walk through it. And I think that's a no-brainer at the end of the day, because, you know, we've all done that as contractors where we'll demo a space, we'll lay it out so the client can walk through and kind of see the floors and things like that. So it's taking it to that next level. You're going to be able to solve a lot of issues, a lot of changes, client changes, design changes by being able to input that into a VR scenario, letting the client see that early on and saying, oh, no, that's not what I thought was going to be there. Change that now. So I think of the VR space is going to be something that we're going to see coming to the forefront soon.
Absolute gold, man. Mm. Seriously. Like, thank you so much for coming and sharing your story. And as we, you know, in the pre-interview, when I kind of talked through this one thing, right. And as serial entrepreneur, I am always challenging myself and challenging others, right? There's so many things we can be doing. Construction's so messy. There's so many things to fix. But Brayson, I'm going to put you on the spot. What is that one thing you want to leave our contractors and affiliates, our Art of Construction master facilitators, to think about to go out and grow their business as lifelong learners running the A-team?
Yeah, absolutely. To me, it's an easy answer. It's going back to this idea of people first, understanding that if you truly want to grow, if you truly want to scale, you will not be able to do that if you can't find the right people to be on your team. You know, as they say in EOS, right people to get on the bus to come with you. So focus on that. Educate yourself on that. Read the books. You know, there's the Who book. There's the Who Not How. There's so many great books out there about this. Dig into how you find the right people, whether it's personality tests, however you want to do it. You know, if you have a key person in your business where if I could replicate this person 10 times over, there's nothing I couldn't do. Understand who they are, how they operate, how you can find more of those people. And then structure and process, I think, is key. I operated for years trying to create my own structure, my own process with no roadmap, no operating system. I was lucky enough to find EOS. There's tons of operating systems out there. EOS isn't the only one. EOS has worked well for us. It's given us a roadmap. It's helped us create a vision for our firm and something that we can follow fairly easily. There's software behind it. So having those two things, the right people, having an operating process is huge at the end of the day. And just doing good work for good people. I mean, that's the big thing at the end of the day for us is if you do really quality work, you won't have to market anymore. You know, so that's, we struggle with that for years of doing work and then going out and marketing. When finally at the end of the day, we realized we just do amazing work for our key clients that we have now. We'll never have to market another day. And that has worked well for us. So take care of your clients, do good quality work, and the rest should take care of itself.
You the man. The perfect touch points. You can't say that stuff enough, right? We always talk about seven times for the first time. And these are my favorite times to go back to what makes a business work. Bryson, we're honored to cooperate with you through the cooperative and what you're doing. Thank you so much for coming in and sharing your story.
Absolutely. Thanks, Devin. Thanks, Matt. It's been a real pleasure. Again, just so great talking to people that have this mentality. And thank you so much for what you're doing for the industry.
Likewise. Matt, so much gold. What's your closing thoughts?
Great interview and somebody with the right mentality and right attitude. You know, one thing I just wanted to share, and given this is kind of a California theme related podcast, is, EOS, I know, and Traction was big for both of you guys. The one thing that was really big for me when I was in Los Angeles was a thing called LifeSpring, and it's experiential education. And one of the things that LifeSpring would always talk about is be, do, have. And people kind of do things in reverse where, you know, if they have a mansion and they have great cars and they do cool stuff and like go to concerts and travel the world, then they'll be happy. And LifeSpring kind of flips it on its head and says, if you'll be a certain way and you do certain things, then you'll have everything that you want. And that's really what I heard with Bryson is that, you know, here is a person that is about being caring and passionate at his very core. He does things that are absolutely in service to his client and customer. And then the have is he gets to have incredible success and satisfaction because he did the be and the do part first. So huge fan of his. Look forward to eventually visiting him in Pasadena. We're either going to go to Pine Burger or the other places. We'll go to Chili John's and have some chili and spaghetti.
Dang it, Matt. I just want to have it all. I first have to be, huh?
You got to be first, man.
You just keep doing and want to have it, right? I mean, and for me, the big thing was we say it all the time and we all have to be reminded of you have to be able to say this little word that's so hard to say in construction because you don't know what the next downturn or what the next problem or what it is. No, I can't do that. But, and the but for him is educational, lifelong learners. And that's the education is, why are you saying no? Because maybe I should be saying no. And then on the next one, we should all be saying yes together if we build a cooperative. That's what I heard. Because Matt, as you said it, there's no teacher like experience. And I think the three of us have kind of the cooperative. And I think that's where Bryson and his evolution of getting a group of lifelong learners that we're putting together and learning from master brands like Nike, just do it. But first, it's people first. Who? Then what? Well, Tribe, I need reminders on this constantly. And it's not fun, but you better know your numbers because you got to be able to, days are long and years are short sometimes, but you better have a documented process. And you better slow down once in a while and work on yourself. Rayom, 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 rayom. Tribe, make it happen. Have as much fun as possible. Just go do it. The first job he did, I can only imagine the time when he said, $8 million, $8 million. But it should have been 14. And he figured it all out. And he learned from that. And that's what EOS or whatever the platform is, it's life can be hard, but it's breaking through that ceiling and learning from that and having a group of lifelong learners that have your back. Matt, thanks for coming in and being another part. It's been too long. But there's times you have to get in the weeds. In fact, I'm sitting on their side of this wall where I have a whole lumber truck out there and everybody is screaming saying, where the hell is what's going on? Because it was supposed to come yesterday. They screwed up. And then it was supposed to be next week. And then they got a track and now it's just sitting out there and everybody's freaking out. But piss poor management is piss poor execution and lack of your problem is not mine. So we all have to work together and understand that because it's not easy, right, Matt?
Yeah, thanks for letting me join you. And I'm so glad I'm not there to have to deal with the lumber truck.
All right, I'm going to go do that. And you'll see me on the LinkedIn on that project that we're showcasing. You make it happen. Bryson, we're huge fans and excited to collaborate more through the cooperative with the AOC Master Facilitators. Crush it out there, Tribe.